From the PA Foundation, I'm James Millward. This is Vital Minds, a podcast series connecting the most vital issues in clinical care with the top minds facing them every day. A few episodes back, we discussed the opioid crisis, with CDC data indicating that there were more than 42,000 overdose deaths in 2016 alone. This is a crisis that we see every day in our communities, in our homes, in our clinics and hospitals, and we can all agree that this is a national epidemic. And it is very critical for all of us to be doing our part to fight the opioid epidemic while realizing the toll of addiction in general. A recent Pew survey found that nearly half of all adults in the United States have a close friend or family member who has suffered from addiction. As PAs, we have the ability to connect our patients with the right resources to aid in recovery from addiction. Here to talk about this with me today is Gianni Migliaccio, PAC. Gianni has a PA degree from the Rochester Institute of Technology and currently works at Ashley Addiction Treatment in Havre de Grace, Maryland, as a PA. Prior to his work at Ashley in Addiction Medicine, Gianni worked in a variety of specialties, including emergency medicine, forensics, and orthopedics. He holds a bachelor's degree in psychology from William Patterson University and has also worked as a personal trainer. Gianni, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, James.
Now, you have a pretty diverse background here. So tell me, what interested you in working in addiction medicine?
I have family members who have struggled with addiction and alcoholism and grew up in a neighborhood in New Jersey that had a lot of addiction and alcoholism, and it's always been an issue that's been close to my heart. I have a background in psychology and personal training, and that really got me interested in improving people's lifestyles and not only helping them increase their wellness and their happiness, but also how they execute their lives, making improvements in family relationships, so on and so forth. And that I saw that really important in helping addicts and alcoholics, that approaching it from the medical scientific perspective, but helping them to make lifestyle changes that will make enacting the things they need to do to get and maintain long-term sobriety possible.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Having that personal connection definitely drives a passion for treating these patients. Now, at the beginning of the episode, I mentioned the statistic that nearly half of American adults have a loved one or family members who have suffered from addiction. Does that surprise you at all?
No, it doesn't. And, you know, growing up, I remember, you know, my aunt who suffered from addiction spoke very openly with me, even though I was a young teenager, about her struggles and was very open. And after she passed away, I was very open about my experience with my aunt, who I loved, and what she struggled with. And, you know, I had some family members who would be hesitant to mention that because of the stigma. And just about every time I brought it up, someone else in the room either had a personal experience with alcoholism or addiction, or had a family member, just about every time. Now you see it through social media and regular media. So many people from every walk of life are affected.
I agree. We're definitely seeing this in every aspect of life now. And you're seeing this firsthand in your practice. These statistics at first can be somewhat alarming, but what is the trend you're seeing recently in practice?
One of the encouraging things is people actually seeking treatment, and that the stigma is beginning to fade. People are beginning to recognize that alcoholism and addiction are diseases, and that they require treatment, that they're not a moral failing, they're not a weakness. And one of the things that's very beautiful to see, these can be very divisive times with people on either side of the political aisle or cultural, spiritual issues. When people come to addiction treatment, you see all walks of life, all religious backgrounds, financial, from the very wealthy to those who have nothing, all coming together and supporting each other. And it's tremendous. You see a coming together of all walks of life that you don't see many other places. You know, the old saying was, you know, we're all equal at birth and in the grave, which is sort of a sombering kind of quote, but here in the treatment of addiction and alcoholism, I've seen that there's another place where we can all be equal and all together and supporting each other.
I agree with that. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke with PA Chris Ortiz about how challenging treating addiction can be because of this stigma that surrounds it, because people are afraid to ask. And I think being able to be prepared for that and to be able to overcome that barrier is huge in treating addictions. Now, aside from the obvious stigma that we have, what other challenges do you see in treating substance use disorders?
A big challenge is knowing what's available. A lot of people are not familiar at all with what the approach is. Finding a facility like Ashley, when you go online, a multitude of facilities with varying levels of quality of care come up. And things can be serious, very complicated by the fact that there are even sites that review rehabs, but those sites are owned by rehabs. So you're not getting a totally independent, unbiased review. So there's the knowledge on the hand of the families and providers of what we can do, what can we do. And that coupled with, there was a counselor I used to work with who said, you know, who would tell patients, you have the only disease in the world that tries to convince you you don't have it. Unlike diabetes, where I can tell you, hey, James, you know, your number is above this number, your blood sugar's number is above this number, you have diabetes. And then, you know, you're more than welcome to refuse treatment or to not seek treatment, but you can't debate the fact that you're a diabetic. It's cut and dry with these numbers. Since there's no black and white test, the denial and the resistance to treatment that is part and parcel of the disease process of addiction and alcoholism will just put the kibosh on getting folks the help they need.
No, that's understandable. It's hard to really pinpoint the diagnosis of addiction for people who are in denial of it.
Yes, and sometimes folks are addicted and are suffering with alcoholism, but they don't display a lot of the negative consequences that people can point to, and they'll use that to defend their usage. They will say things like, hey, you know, I haven't missed a day of work in years. I'm a provider for my family. I'm an upstanding member of my community. They'll point to all the negative sequelae of addiction and alcoholism, and since they're not having it, they may not feel that they have a problem.
Now, as PAs or medical providers in general, what tools do you suggest for assessing patients with substance use disorders?
Well, there's usually a quick evidence-based approach to assessing a person's use history, is like the CAGE questions. But really, what I think most PAs in private practice can do when they're assessing a person's drug and alcohol usage is, firstly, you know, the quantity, the frequency, if they're getting an honest report, but the impact it's having in any areas of life. Because really, the hallmark of addiction is continued use despite negative consequences. So you can have a patient who you may have been following their liver function tests, and they continue to be elevated, but the person continues to drink. Issues at home, issues at work, desire to quit drinking but continuing to drink or use drugs. Those can all be indicators if it's a person who's not just coming out with it saying, oh, by the way, you know, I'm here for my physical, but I think I may have a drinking problem. I think I have a drug problem.
Yeah, I think looking at the impact to their everyday life is a huge aspect of this. Now, for treating patients with addictions, specifically with opioid addictions, there are certain tools that PAs need to have, such as the DEA X waiver, to make sure we can actually effectively use medically assisted treatment in our patients. Is there anything aside from that DEA X, or have you found that to be a very good thing in your practice?
The X waiver is interesting. The X waiver is only to prescribe Suboxone or Subutex, buprenorphine. That's a special X designation on your DEA, so you could prescribe Suboxone or Subutex. Now, it's interesting, if the prescribing of Suboxone usually has to happen in a practice that is set up to do Suboxone maintenance, as opposed to where methadone, federal law only allows you to dispense methadone at a methadone treatment clinic. Suboxone is done as an outpatient, but it's not done just by primary care doctors. But people who are interested can find out what the legality is so that they can start prescribing Suboxone, like to make their practice compliant to be able to prescribe Suboxone and monitor their Suboxone treatment. And yes, an X waiver. But for using other medications for the treatment of, for opioids, it's going to be Suboxone or methadone. And again, methadone is at a clinic, and then Suboxone requires a special situation for you to be able to set it up. See, we use it here at Ashley because we're an inpatient facility, so we're prescribing it for detox, which is a little bit different. But the other medications that can help with alcoholism and addiction, like acamprosate and naltrexone, injectable naltrexone, those medications do not require any special DEA license. They're not controlled substances, and they're also very safe and they don't interact with a lot of medication. So I think making PAs aware of those two options especially, as well as good old-fashioned antabuse, which is also not a controlled substance, making them aware of their safety, their efficacy, and how they can implement them in their practices immediately is very important. Because what I find is with both patients and medical providers of various levels, PA, nurse practitioner, physicians, and so forth, the majority of them are not aware of either option of acamprosate or the injectable naltrexone. They're just not aware of how to use those.
Yeah, increasing our own education of the available medications and treatments is a major step in tackling this opioid addiction problem. Now, many of these patients who abuse substances are often self-medicating. Would you recommend screening for other mental health conditions such as anxiety or depression in your addiction patients?
Yes, I would. And that's something that happens here at Ashley. And what I would advise PAs to do is to take a look at, you know, what do they do at Ashley? What services do they provide? And how can I provide those services in that format as an outpatient? The really tough thing is there's no perfect questionnaire. You should be an inpatient. You can do outpatient. And even if there were, some people will just, for a multitude of reasons, refuse inpatient treatment. So I think as an outpatient PA, like we just talked about, is initially recognizing the problem or having a patient who expresses a problem and then beginning the process and evaluation for underlying psychiatric disorders, because those tend to be higher in, not all alcoholics and addicts suffer from psychiatric issues like depression, anxiety, but a higher percentage than the general population do. It's kind of like smoking. Smoking is much higher. Not all addicts and alcoholics smoke cigarettes, but it's much higher percentage amongst those suffering with addiction and alcoholism. So getting an initial assessment and then having them see a psychologist or a psychiatrist and having these folks on hand is critical, because the psychiatrists in particular, if anyone's experienced looking for a psychiatrist, you go on your insurance company's website, you look for psychiatrists, the closest one to you is a 50-minute drive, and they're not taking appointments for 3 to 6 months. It can be really, really difficult. It's a very underserved area. So a PA proactively getting connected with those resources in their area can, when that patient comes in and says, I'm struggling, because the thing is, when they're in that office, it takes a lot to admit that you're struggling. The iron is hot and they're giving you a chance. And if you can respond with, okay, here's the plan. We're going to start talking about some medications that can help you with addiction and alcoholism. We're also going to have you see a psychologist or psychiatrist or counselor, find one that's addiction medicine experienced that can assess both their addiction and alcoholism and underlying disorders. And you can start to move forward that way, as opposed to somebody lays this out for you and you're like, well, let me get back to you. This person, that you know, the stigma, the fear, the addiction can draw them back in where they're not going to come back for help.
I think that's a great point. Having those resources on hand can be so powerful. And I see that on the inpatient side, where I'm in cardiac surgery, and every week we receive consults and admissions on patients that are coming in for bacterial endocarditis that have become bacteremic and septic because of their IV drug use. And now they're ending up with vegetations on their valves, they require open heart operations and valve replacements. But while they're inpatient with us, we have the opportunity to get those consults and get them in touch with the psychiatrists, the psychologists, the treatment programs, and extend that care going forward. But you have to have those resources on hand. You have to know where to go for these patients.
Certainly. And that's a great point. I talk to fellow providers, and that's what they tell me, whatever, especially in the surgical specialties, and they're dealing with the sequelae of addiction and alcoholism, or are dealing with a person who now has a disease unrelated to their alcoholism or addiction and may be in recovery and they're not sure what to do about their pain. That's another aspect that might be out of the scope of this podcast, but knowing what to do with someone in recovery or trying to get in recovery in terms of pain control, what pain medications safe or not for someone in recovery and what should I do. But I've had patients here at Ashley who've had their route to us was from having surgery for endocarditis or prolonged hospitalizations for endocarditis. And they were lucky enough to, after they recovered well enough, they were approached by social work and care facilitators at the hospital, you know, who knew what to do. I would think about all of the things, starting with okay, if this person wants to try to stop on their own, opiates, for example, are very safe. For a generally healthy person can quit opiates without medical management. It'll be very, very uncomfortable, a lot of pain, sweating, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, but people do detox at home and they can detox cold turkey safely. There's also places they can go to do just the detox portion from opiates, but I think the salient point is for the provider to know that opiate detox is not as dangerous as alcohol detox. That being said, people can be guided through detox at home with prescription medications for sedatives detox at home, but depending on their level of health, how long and how much they've been drinking, that can be really dangerous. So knowing all that, your first step would be, okay, my patient's here, they want help, they're not ready for inpatient treatment for their own reasons. What's my next step? Can they detox on their own? Is there a short-term detox facility that I can go to? Is there someone I can refer them to who has experience in detoxing them as an outpatient? And then once they're detoxed, they begin individual and group counseling. So I would start with the counseling piece, group and individual, try to find a psychiatrist in the area that takes this patient's insurance, and then I would start to encourage participation for patients in some kind of meeting. And what most people know about, they know AA and they know NA, the 12-step-based approaches, which I highly recommend. It's helped millions of people. But there are other options. I think one of the criticisms of AA and NA, which aren't actual criticisms of the approach themselves, is that it's not for everybody. Well, of course, not every form of exercise is for everyone. Not every form of therapy or any individual therapist fits every patient. And I think providers, again, being aware that there are other options like Celebrate Recovery, which is a Christian-based recovery meetings for recovering alcoholics and addicts. Then there's also SMART recovery meetings, which are cognitive behavioral therapy based. Those are for people who are less inclined to pursue a spiritual approach that AA, NA, and Celebrate Recovery has. But again, the provider knowing this ahead of time is valuable because you have the tool, but is also, I think, comforting to this person who's broken through their own fears of stepping forward and saying that they have a problem and saying, wow, you know, I told this person I had a problem and they didn't look at me like I had three heads. They actually had answers because, and you know, whether they're conscious of it or not, they'll know that, wow, other people are struggling like I am. If I were the only one struggling this way, this individual would not know these resources, would not be able to point me to these steps. And then building that into their lifestyle, building in follow-up appointments and making sure they're not lost to follow-up are all things that a PA in private practice can do for people.
I really like that plan that you laid out there. I think you've definitely shown how PAs can be an effective part of this solution. I imagine before you can really even connect patients with the right treatment, you have to establish a relationship there. You have to dig a little bit deeper and be able to target their needs as an individual. Now tell us, how do you go about building trust with a patient to provide them that comfort and, you know, that level of openness with you to speak about their addiction, about their problems, and what their goals are to assess their readiness for treatment?
I think that really starts with how you feel about addiction and alcoholism. I love the quote by Dr. Osler, the first step in caring for the patient is caring about the patient. If you really, truly, intellectually, and emotionally believe that addiction and alcoholism is a disease and that this person is suffering and needs help, you're going to very naturally give the message to that person that you care. And it will be no different than any other condition, any embarrassing condition. I'm sure every PA experiences the fact that patients will come in and be very embarrassed to talk about any issue they're having. My personal approach is because I am so passionate about helping alcoholics and addicts, it's easy for me to respond based on that person. But the basics of it is that I don't respond with surprise or shock, because it's not surprising or shocking. And I'm immediately reassuring to the patient of how this is, you are making a great step. And really, it depends on what the patient says to me and their level of discomfort. You know, I've had anywhere from patients who were terrified that people would find out they were in treatment. And one man, you know, he was in his 50s and you know, eventually I said, you know, he settled down a bit and I said, you know, what if worst case scenario on the cover of the New York Times showed up your picture and a headline saying your full name, where you're from, and the fact that you were in treatment for alcoholism, and it ran all over the country? What would worst case scenario? And he just kind of looked at me and he kind of laughed. And I told him, I said, you know, this is alcoholism. A lot of people suffer with this. And a lot of very, and again, that going back to the diversity of backgrounds, a lot of very successful, accomplished people, very wonderful people, good people, whether they're local heroes in their community or names we all know, have struggled with this illness. And so utilizing approaches like that, I'm with you. I understand what you're going through. What you're going through is not at all uncommon. It's not your fault. And we're going to help you. You're going to get the help you need. And this is a great first step. And I appreciate your openness and your honesty. And I know how hard it is to say those simple words. I think I have a drinking problem. I think I have a problem with drugs.
I think that's a great approach there. Now, bringing in your life experiences, you were a personal trainer when you started out your career. Do you find that you use any of those same lessons you learned as a coach to, you know, motivate and empower your patients through the recovery process?
Absolutely. One of the common myths of exercise and physical fitness and training is that the people who are very successful at it love all that stuff. You know, I have a friend who set the deadlift record in two states, in two different weight classes, and he trained really hard while he was a full-time student. And he told me that people often say, oh, you're lucky you like to eat and train that way. And he always laughed and thought, it's not that I like it, it's that I like the results I get, so I find ways of making it work for me. And I find that across the board. Sure, there are certain things you're going to like the working out portion, the exercise portion. And we talk to addicts and alcoholics. Some people love the meetings. They just enjoy being there. Others plow through because they know it helps. Some people love seeing their counselors. Others just do it because they know it works and they like other aspects of it. But whatever you're doing, whenever you're trying to generate that lifestyle, and I believe being able to lose weight and maintain your weight loss is going to take a very similar approach to how we are addressing alcoholism and addiction in the United States before we see any major changes in our rates of obesity and overweight. Because the ability to self-regulate and eat well and exercise is subject to all the difficulties that addicts and alcoholics face when they're trying to stay sober. And as a matter of fact, if you ask someone that you're treating for diabetes, blood pressure, these metabolic disorders can be improved a whole lot by diet and exercise. When you ask people why they stopped exercising or why they fell off their new nutrition plan, you will hear a lot of the same reasons that addicts and alcoholics give for relapsing: the stress at work, stress, family stress, anxiety, depression, all of these issues. And there are some inpatient facilities that are treating very overweight and obese people with a very similar approach: group individual counseling, medications for co-occurring disorders, teaching people how to cook and exercise. And I think that sort of informed my approach to addiction and alcoholism. Losing track of a good program of recovery. One of the things I hear from patients who come back to Ashley after relapsing, one of the big things that I hear is, I stopped working my program. And whatever shape that program was for them, whatever medications were involved, whatever types of meetings they went to, whatever relationships they had with a sponsor or type of program, whatever that was, they drifted away from it. It was going well for 6, 7, 8 months. They drifted away. So that's where the motivation, the personal, how does a person get this done? Most people suffering with alcoholism and addiction don't have the resources for that kind of, either don't have the resources or it would be impractical to have that kind of oversight or accountability in place. Now, they do have those programs for medical providers and pilots, for example, who suffer with alcoholism and addiction because use can affect the lives of other people. So they're very strictly regulated. And medical providers and pilots tend to do very, very well because they get that full court press. They are looking at what I tell my patients is addiction and alcoholism. You are up against the heavyweight champ. And the champ cheats and he fights dirty and he wins more fights than he loses. But that being said, you can win. The heavyweight champ can be dethroned. It's just going to take a full court press. Knowing what each individual needs to get well and how are we going to implement this in a realistic way, so that it works for them and continues with them, because, of course, addiction and alcoholism are chronic problems that are never cured. They can be treated well, and the recovery that you see day in, day out is incredible. It's one of the best parts of my job is seeing people recover, and from the lows, the depths that they hit both physically, mentally, and spiritually and in their personal lives, then to the heights that they can reach. But to get there will take a consistent approach over time.
I think you covered a lot of great information with that. It has to be a major lifestyle change. And aiding our patients in that process is where we can find a very fulfilling role. Now, Gianni, for the PA students listening in, can you draw from your experience and give a piece of advice for working with patients who are diagnosed with these substance use disorders?
The most important piece of advice I can give is to have patience and compassion for them and to understand that the negative behaviors you're experiencing, the lying, the abusive language, the just sometimes downright meanness is not who they are. Those are symptoms of the disease process. If you can see that from patience and compassion as a symptom, doesn't mean that you're going to enable those behaviors or allow those behaviors to continue and so forth. Obviously, allowing patients to be abusive to staff isn't acceptable. And those are addressed. But if you can see them as a symptom of a disease process, then I think it'll make it easier for you to treat those symptoms with compassion, with kindness, and for you to leave at the end of the day less stressed. When they get better, you will see tremendous change. And it's something beautiful to see.
I think that's a very good point. Now, Gianni, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome, James. Happy to be here. This has been a great conversation, and I hope that there's some ideas that our colleagues in the community could use.
I agree. This has been a great conversation about a very important topic. For all of you listening, be sure to visit the PA Foundation website at pa-foundation.org to find more resources on this important topic and catch any episodes of Vital Minds you may have missed. The PA Foundation is the philanthropic arm of the American Academy of PAs. Our mission is to empower PAs to improve health through philanthropy and service. Support for this episode of Vital Minds is provided by Indivior, a global specialty pharmaceutical company with a 20-year legacy in patient advocacy and health policy, as well as an education on evidence-based treatment models. Until next time, everyone, I'm James Millward, and this is Vital Minds.